Thank you for joining us today for the fifth episode of the Whitaker Report, a discussion with thought leaders about the future of economic development, site selection, and corporate real estate. My name is Dean Whitaker, CEO of Whitaker Associates, a data analytic company serving the needs of economic development and commercial real estate organizations. I will be your host as we endeavor to see around the corner. Today, we will be speaking with Gene Dupree, Managing Partner, Global Innovation Partners. Gene has over 35 years of experience working with corporations and consulting with associations and government entities on strategy implementation and cultural transformation in North America and Europe. He has advised more than 400 Fortune 1000 CEOs and other executives in executing global location strategies and site selection across the broad spectrum of sectors. He has led complex assignments involving worldwide location decisions, expansions, and merger and acquisition consolidations related to headquarters, research centers, manufacturing, and other specialized operations. Projects have included overall global strategy and comprehensive regional, county, and city assessments, and a comprehensive site selection execution involving individual projects totaling more than $5 billion in capital investment and thousands of high-paying jobs. Mr. Dupree has also provided insight and collaborative innovation-based economic development strategies to over 100 development organizations at the national, state, and provincial and metropolitan regional levels in the United States, Canada, Mexico, UK, and Europe. Please join me as we welcome Gene Dupree to the Whitaker Report. Thank you, Gene, for joining us today for a discussion about site selection and strategic location strategies that you've been using in your career. As we were preparing for our talk, you were talking about your first employment, and it sounds like you and I had a similar one, but tell us a little about your first job.
Well, the first job that I had, and probably other people have had a similar experience, was as a newspaper carrier. Newspaper carrier. And it was an early morning, 4:30 in the morning, and my employer was the Gannett Company, which at that point was headquartered in my hometown, Rochester, New York. So get up, you know, and if there's 4 feet of snow on the ground, you somehow get through all that to pick up your papers, bring them back to your route, and better weather, you'd ride a bike and do all that. But it was kind of a full picture of business because you had to deliver the goods, of course, keep track of all of that, and then collect. Collection is always the least favorite part of it. But that's how I got to learn how to deal with people and make change.
And make change, too, and collect.
I had one of those little coin changers on my belt. It was a lot of fun.
Interesting. So tell me, how did you get your next career? So you're moving down the trail here. So what was your first awareness and involvement in anything that was similar to location strategy and that type of work?
Well, unlike many of my peers in the location consulting or site selection business, I have a very broad background, a very mixed background, which I think is what has led me to the particular way I approach global location strategy. The mix is really one of communications, which is my academic background in visual communications, which I did in a university setting for a few years, and then moved to Kodak, where I did the big multimedia presentations, and that got me into a wide variety of marketing communications and public affairs. And one of those public affairs assignments was a community development project to help people in the greater Rochester area, again, my hometown, understand the housing crisis, a shortage of housing for low and moderate income housing people. And so I got introduced into community development and the jump from there into economic development. After leaving Kodak, I went into university communications as head of university communications at Rochester Institute of Technology. And had a big staff and did all kinds of things. But I also, in that context, learned to work with very senior executives, the trustees of the university, executives of the university itself. So I always felt very comfortable working with peer groups that were senior executives. And I think, you know, that mix, which prepared me for the next step in my career, really helped me explain very complex and difficult issues to people, be comfortable with peer-to-peer relationships with senior executives. And, you know, after that period of time, part of it was setting up a community partnership organization focused on economic development and building community partnerships. So that kind of led me into that next stage of economic development, community development activities, building partnerships, getting groups to work together, feeling comfortable with working with minority community leaders, neighborhood leaders, as well as chief executives of major corporations and government leaders in between. So that mix, I think, has kind of carried through my life. And then as I transitioned into Washington, D.C., where I led a national association that was affiliated and started by the White House and the National Association of Manufacturers and other national groups, I was able to continue that process of working with a broad cross-section of people, encouraging volunteerism, partnership building among various kinds of groups. And it was out of that that I got recruited into the Fantas Company, which started me on my career in location consulting and what was then called site selection, which is a term I don't use anymore because I think it's very limited and doesn't really communicate the true nature of location strategy and all the issues that go along with it.
So tell us a little about this whole concept of location strategy and how you got there. So now you're at the Fantas Company and you're working with companies to help them implement kind of their strategic plan, but using the site selection process to do so. Is that what you were doing?
Right. And when I first joined Fantas as the vice president, I was in the economic development strategy area because I was a strategist, and that's why I was recruited to really work with states and communities on that side of it. But a couple of years at Fantas, I moved over into the corporate location practice area, particularly high-tech headquarters office areas, which was the emerging area for Fantas. It had been largely involved in manufacturing, and our New York office was focused more on high-tech research and development headquarters, really major emphasis on headquarters. So as I began working with that, it was clear to me that this had to be tied to moving upstream and really working with executives who were the decision makers in their companies, often CEOs and chief operating officers and later chief financial officers, on their long-term strategy, what they were trying to achieve and how location strategy could complement that and really work with it. So I think the whole term that is so often used, site selection, really to me is limited in that it implies more selecting a city or selecting even more narrowly a building or a greenfield development, which made a lot of sense in the early years. But as we advanced the profession, it was important to really understand what the companies were trying to do, what their culture was, what their long-term strategies were, and how location could really help that along.
Could you give us some examples of projects that you've worked on with that in mind?
Yeah, two immediately come to mind, and there's many others. I think I've done about 800 to date. One is the UPS headquarters. United Parcel Service was in Greenwich, Connecticut, and I got a call one day. A guy says, "Hi, I'm Ozzie Nelson." And I said, "Yeah," and I'm Harriet. He said, "No, I really am Ozzie Nelson. I'm the CEO of UPS. We're thinking about moving our company from Greenwich into another larger city because of the logistics of what we're doing and where our employees are coming from. And as we become more and more an international company, can you help us?" And so we start off with a set of meetings with him in the employee cafeteria. He says, "I don't want this to be a secret, but I really don't want people to know what we're thinking about because it would scare them." And we were sitting at a little cafeteria table talking about the future of moving 1,000 employees to somewhere. We're not sure where. But it was very, very important to establish the criteria. He put together a small group of executives. We defined what the criteria was, what was really important to them. And we literally flew that group of 13 executives around the country to the short list of cities that they were considering and looking at. And the decision was made on the plane. As we came back, we talked to all the executives. He talked to his executives, and on the runway after we landed, they made a tentative decision, which we then confirmed with more specific information. But it was all about the strategy of how they could continue their growth practice, how they could move to a city that would be comfortable with their executives, most of whom had come up through the ranks, had started literally as truck drivers, as he had, as Nelson had, and moved up the ranks. And that has continued to this day, literally to last week, when the first outsider CEO was named. It's always been company people who most often started, in the logistics side of it, often driving trucks and working up. It was a phenomenal project. They wound up in moving 90% of their employees, including clerical workers and support staff, to what ultimately was chosen as Atlanta. The other one that comes to mind is Novartis. Novartis chief executive and his board were considering consolidating biotech research from all over the world. They had what groups they'd be bringing together, what that meant in terms of number of employees and facilities that were required. All of this had to be done in 12 weeks, including the decision of where in the world to locate this new center. And we did it in 12 weeks, and it was focused really on, it ultimately became focused on the USA, so it'd be close to FDA, which was really the dominant regulator from a worldwide standpoint. And they very much wanted to be involved with the university, where their people could mingle with faculty researchers and work together. So we were able to narrow it down to a number of places, ultimately to the Boston area and ultimately to MIT, where they literally located in an MIT faculty and teaching building initially before they redeveloped the Necco factory on the other side of the street from the campus as their permanent home and headquarters. That grew from 300, 400 scientists brought in from all over the world to, I think it's probably 3,000 or 4,000 people now working in that operation, still working very closely with MIT, Harvard, and other universities. Those were two projects that I think really get at this whole thing of understanding corporate strategy, working with the top executives and their managers down through the ranks to understand what the needs were, what the talent requirements were, what the other requirements were, so they could really define for them a long list, then a short list, and then ultimately the best place for them to be.
What are some of the trends that you're seeing now, Gene, out in the world as you continue helping companies with their implement their strategies? What are some of the trends that you're seeing?
Well, there's a lot of trends, and of course they're changing radically as a result of COVID and the worldwide shakeup of how we do everything. But let's talk about the general trends pre-COVID that have just been, I think, magnified. With COVID, the biggest trend, of course, is finding the right talent, and that has many aspects to it, including the quantity of the talent that may be available in the location that you're looking at, the ability to attract recruits into that new location, or even your present location if it's a decision of do you stay where you are or do you go somewhere else. But it also has to do with what's the pipeline like? What are people in the local universities or the colleges, the community colleges, the high schools, are they going to provide the kind of base of talent that you're going to need 5-10 years down the road, as well as the attractiveness of the community to be able to recruit people, move people, transfer people into that location? So that's a huge trend. Globalization, of course, has been a major trend over the last decade or more, and that continues. Our competition with China and other emerging economies and how we stay on top of all of that. And these are mostly global companies that we work with. So they are very conscious of the globalization issues, the logistics issues, and all the other things that come along with it. I'd say on the top of that is talent and market access are two really major trends that kind of really force, I think, the weighting of decisions.
Do you see that reshoring happening, or is that just kind of only in certain niche areas?
Well, no, I think it's definitely happening, and it's in some areas, but it's also, I think, appropriate for some companies, but not for other companies. I think COVID, again, has increased the concern about that, of knowing that your supply lines are manageable, that you're not depending on supply chains that are stretched across the world that could be affected by things you have no control over. And I think that's bringing some companies back to a focus of what can we do in North America that that helps us have that kind of certainty. Certainty, of course, is a key factor. It always has been. You know, companies are really looking for predictability and certainty. And when you've got everything from COVID to the issues of logistics and China and all those things constantly haunting you, you're looking for certainty. And the more you can pin down, it's not only about cost, it's not only about talent, it's not only about the other business advantages you might have, it's about how much risk is out there. And how can you make decisions that are really going to come up with the proper blend or the proper trade-offs between the qualities that you're looking for in a business location, the costs of doing business in that location, which will vary depending on the type of project, but always looking at risk as well. What's the risk of operating here, both short-term and long-term?
Very interesting. What concerns you the most as you look into your crystal ball, looking out into the future? What are some of the things that you, what concerns you as you look down the road?
Well, I think the big concern, and something we all talk about virtually every day, is what the world's going to be like when we get past this crunch with COVID. You know, it looks like we're moving in the right direction, and that by summer, late fall, or the end of the year, with the exception of variants that might come along, we should be in better shape to get back into, quote, normal life. But I don't think anything is going to be normal. I think everything is going to be. We've broken a lot of habits. We've caused a lot of companies and decision makers, not only in business but in government and in the not-for-profit sector, to think about how they've done things forever. Are those really the best ways? Is there other ways of dealing with all of this? And probably first and foremost in all of that is remote working. The huge difference that has been required with people working at home and working in remote locations, and the impact that that's going to have, and how much we're going to return to what it was. I think it's not going to go back to the way it was. I think it's going to be a major shift to some kind of hybrid of many more remote workers, particularly in the professional services areas and the technical areas and among professionals, but also in advanced manufacturing and other areas where a lot of things can be done remotely and pulled together through networks. So I think that's going to have terrific impact in terms of how companies make decisions, how they attract the talent that they need, finding the talent, and the talent on the other side is going to say, you know, we don't like all this commuting. We don't like all this cost of living in big metropolitan areas. We want to work remotely, or we want to work in smaller communities. So that in turn is going to have a huge impact on the real estate markets, on how cities thrive. I think smaller cities, medium-sized cities, are potentially going to thrive if they can demonstrate that high quality of life. And by working remotely with hybrid kinds of systems, I don't think it means that the big cities, New York, Los Angeles, San Jose, San Francisco are going to suddenly dry up. But I think there's going to be far more variations in terms of how companies make decisions and where they locate people. So I don't know whether that's a concern as much as it's a big change. And I think companies and communities, economic developers across the board, is going to have to be aware that it's not going to be business as usual. It's going to be major, major changes, which great opportunities, of course, for those of us that advise companies and communities in terms of what they need to do to adjust to the new realities.
Well, I'm seeing where some communities now offer to pay people to move there. And so back to the talent attraction piece, Tulsa being one. And I think Vermont as a state was offering remote workers $10,000 to move there and set up shop. I heard another one a couple of days ago, and it gets back to something you worked on early in your career, which is affordable housing. And one community was offering a $10,000 incentive for someone to move there, but a $20,000 incentive if they would come there and build a house. So if they
I think there's going to be a lot of creative thinking on the part of cities and economic development organizations that will offer those kinds of new incentives that are incentives that are really going to the employees, to the workforce, as opposed to the companies, and probably less so in terms of outright and financial incentives in terms of buildings and long-term tax incentives. I think it's going to be more directed to the employee base, which is really going to be driving this whole thing. Where do people want to live? Where do they want to work? You know, what's the attractiveness of being there? And as companies sort out where they can best be located to attract the best talent, they're going to have to really understand where those pools of talent are locating and why they're locating and how they can leverage that for their own corporate success.
Very interesting. In terms on the employee side, I think you're right. The example I was thinking about is a community in Oklahoma that offered, there was a company moving there that was bringing 200 employees, and that's they offered them that incentive. So the incentive they were offering was to the employees and not necessarily the company. But the company found that to be in their best interest. So they were more than willing to accept that offer to their employees.
And this gets back to the hybrid kind of operations that you no longer need to have everybody concentrated in one corporate headquarters. And of course, that's a long time trend. And people working remotely and, you know, the professional service firms that I've been involved in, PricewaterhouseCoopers and then IBM, you know, I never went in all the time I was at IBM. All those years, I think I was in an IBM office probably less than 5% of the time.
Wow.
You know, I was on a plane, obviously. I was in client sites. I was working at home. But 40, 50% of my time was travel. And there was no need to go into an IBM office or before that into a PricewaterhouseCoopers office other than for, you know, an occasional corporate meeting. But for the most part, you know, we were out working with clients. And that's what made it interesting to me. That's what serviced the clients best. And it's obviously saved the companies lots of real estate costs because there was fewer and fewer people actually going into an office every day. This has now all been heightened because of COVID, and I think a lot of companies that were reluctant to do that now have been forced to have the experience of working with remote workers and found out, hey, this is not bad. In fact, in many cases, and some research indicates that the productivity rates are really increased. So if communities beyond the big coastal communities that have really been the attraction over the last, you know, 10, 20, 30 years, I think smaller communities, medium-sized communities, I'm sitting in one of them. That's why we moved back to Rochester. I think Rochester is well poised to attract that kind of activity. The infrastructure is in place. You know, the huge corporations that were here have spun off all kinds of technical people and professional people, and you can really pull that together with a great quality of life that goes back to the legacy of places like Rochester and Toledo and Tulsa and others that you know, may have been major corporate centers at one point. Those corporations have shrunk, but the talent is still there. The infrastructure is still there. The cultural and recreational amenities are still there, you know, larger in scale than they probably should be for the size of towns, because they were corporate centers at one point. So it, I think it bodes well. And that's one of the reasons we came back here. You know, we live downtown. We can walk everywhere to theater, to music, to restaurants, to recreational activities. At least we could up until March, but hopefully we'll be doing that again soon.
So in terms of what mid-sized cities can do to be attractive to talent, it sounds like infrastructure and quality of life is probably the place where they need to bet their chips. Is that your feeling?
Yeah, I think so. You know, providing an attractive quality of life. You know, we've always talked about quality of life. It was poo-pod back, you know, 20, 30 years ago when I was first starting and all this. Well, you know, that's just one of these soft kinds of things. And for a manufacturing economy, it kind of was, because most of the people you were recruiting already lived in the community. They knew they wanted to live there, and that's the way they were. But as things became more technical, more professional, more advanced, then it was harder to attract people from outside, where much of that talent had to be attracted, unless you had a good quality of life, good schools, good recreational opportunities, good culture and restaurant life. All those things really became very, very important, and they will continue to become even more important. But, you know, with the medium size and smaller cities, they're also much more accessible. You know, all the time I was living in the New York metro area, every place I went, you know, into the city or whatever, were hour, 2 hour, 3 hour commutes. You never knew what you were going to be running into. Hmm. Now I can get to everywhere within 15, 20 minutes, yet I'm still within a population center of a million people with all the talent, all, you know, 18 universities, all those kinds of things easily available for people for a city like this.
Very cool. Gene, I wanted to say thank you for your time today. We really appreciate your thoughtful reflection on both your career and what you've learned along the way, and also how it's impacted your process of looking at global strategy implementation and using the site selection process to help. I guess it's not a selection process. Using site selection as a way to help communities and companies implement their strategy.
And really help them, both sides, both the economic development community and the corporate community, better understand all these issues and where they can find the right blend and the right mix to best achieve their objectives.
Thank you for your time, Gene.
Good. And great to be with you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Whitaker Report, Seeing Around Corners, and a special thank you to Gene Dupree for helping us better understand the changes taking place in the global location strategy and site selection as we respond to the rapidly changing world around us. Again, my name is Dean Whitaker, your host. Please subscribe to the Whitaker Report podcast on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcast. Thank you for listening.